through the ministry of Eric Alexander in the States, the name of St. George Strawn is widely known. There are many Christians on the other side of the Atlantic who would want to send greetings to this congregation tonight. I had the privilege of speaking, not in the hall, but in the church, during the ministry of the Reverend Tom Allen, after he had made the turn to an evangelical commitment, and he had asked me if ever I got to Glasgow to come, and he would ask a number of ministers with whom he'd been associated through the years and whom he wanted to hear a message about the claim of evangelical Christianity. And I had that privilege with a considerable group of some 30 or 35 ministers in St. George's Tron the last time I was there. I welcome you tonight, and it's a great privilege for me. I have a friend who says that whenever he gets an exalted introduction, he has to pray two prayers. One for the distinguished chairman for making all those exaggerations, and the other for himself for enjoying it so much. Not long ago, I was on my way to Purdue University, which is one of our Big Ten, to address a faculty luncheon. The affair was arranged by a dozen or so evangelical believers on that faculty. And as it turned out, there were more than 100 who attended, many out of curiosity. Earlier that morning, I had flown from Washington, D.C., near where I live, to Dayton, Ohio, where I caught a Piedmont commuter plane to Indianapolis, and there I was met by a four-seater Cessna that was piloted by a Purdue professor, an engineering specialist, and he was accompanied by a local clergyman who had been a former student of mine. Well, when we were 4,000 feet aloft, the professor pilot laconically remarked, "Our plane spotter has just died." What does that mean? Said my flustered clergyman friend. And I was glad he asked the question. "No problem," answered the pilot. "It's just that nobody can any longer tell where we are." Now that laconic comment, in many ways, is an apt description of our present cultural condition. The West has lost its moral and epistemic compass bearings, and nobody seems any longer to be able to tell where we are. For centuries, the West towered head and shoulders above its pagan past. Now the signs of neo-paganism everywhere confront us. No longer are the neo-pagans merely dancing on the fringes of society and scaling the walls of modern culture. They have entered into the cultural mainstream and are setting an agenda. It should be plain as day to anyone aware of the history of ideas that the unique features of the Western view of life and of the cosmos were rooted in the Hebrew Christian scriptures, and that apart from the supernatural God of the Bible, they cannot long survive. And yet, social critics lack consensus about the present condition. It's just that nobody can tell where we are. There's a fascinating line in Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. They lived at the bottom of a well. I venture to suggest that in terms of the history of ideas, the they may well be we ourselves, our beleaguered generation, and that the well has run dry. Once the well was full, brimful, it nurtured the life of a spiritual and moral society unmatched in the history of humanity. Recall Eric Veglin's words that the Hebrews or Hebrew history began on a level, it began on a level that other societies have tried to reach at their very peak and successively failed. Now we live at the bottom of a well that has run dry, and that seems to offer little prospect but disintegration. I propose to take a hurried look at the costly stifling of God since the dawning of the Christian era. Since Jesus Christ came into the world and the early church confronted Greco-Roman paganism, that progressive smothering of God has betrayed modern thought at last to neo-paganism, to raw naturalism that suffocates every last vestige of transcendence, and now flirts again with ancient pre-Christian motifs like chance and fatalistic determinism. In his inaugural address in Cambridge University, C.S. Lewis remarked that even the paganism of New Testament times had more in common with Christianity than either of them now has with the emerging neo-paganism of our own day. The younger generation now scarcely realizes how far modern culture has drifted from its one-time biblical anchorage, and the staggering indebtedness of Western thought to the biblical heritage, even to its broken fragments, to which many of your parents and grandparents still cling. To the Judeo-Christian view, we owe the belief that the universe is a purposive creation and not self-explanatory, that human beings are of equal dignity, and that all human life is sacred, that is different from the animals. That history is linear and moves toward a final goal. That nature is an orderly system, and that man at its apex is the responsible steward of the cosmos. That righteousness will triumph in a decisive final conquest of evil. That this earthly life does not exhaust human existence, but looks ahead to a resurrection and final judgment of mankind and of the nations. Were there time, I could quote from many authorities, both secular and Christian, who concede and underscore all this and much more. The historian Foulkes Jackson, who said that all the humanitarian movements of the West took their origin in the theology of the cross. The political scientist John Halliwell, who said that the loss of the biblical doctrine of man's creation in the image of God leaves us without any firm case for human equality. A.N. Whitehead and Stanley Yockey, who say that in its pursuit of the detailed behavior of nature, modern science was nurtured by the Christian view of God as the sovereign creator and preserver of nature, and that it is no accident that modern science did not arise in the Orient. Or Ernst Bloch and Johannes Metz, who trace the modern revolutionary longing for a political utopia to the biblical emphasis on a future final kingdom of justice and righteousness, even if, let me add, liberation theology gives this hope a perverse form. Of course, it's not only in recent modern times or even only in the Middle Ages, that Christianity has had to contend with the obscuring of its own message and meaning. Some of its professing friends, no less than its foes, have always clouded the meaning and implications of the Christian religion. Early Christianity had to cope with its Jimmy Swaggarts and Jim Bakers, as Paul's letter to the Corinthians reminds us, and with many like ourselves, whose lives may not always suggest the motif of sanctification. But Hebrew theism was not invalidated by the failure and exile of the Hebrews. And a televangelist's lurid 20-minute bedroom affair does not disprove Christianity. It tells us more about anthropology than it does about theology. The Protestant reformers protested the medieval infusion of legends into Christianity. They protested the distortion of redemption into a faith plus works misunderstanding that included sacramental salvation. And they protested the Thomistic view of natural theology that blurred the noetic and volitional consequences of sin. By insisting on the fivefold proof of God, Thomas reduced the role of divine revelation in man's knowledge of God, and indirectly encouraged speculative theism that devalued divine revelation. From its beginnings in 1600, with a Jesuit philosopher, Descartes, modern philosophy substituted speculative theism for revelatory scriptural theism. It no longer rested the case for God's existence on God's self-revelation, on inspired prophetic apostolic teaching, on divine incarnation in Jesus Christ, but on philosophical arguments from the not God, from nature, from the pattern of history, or from man himself, especially his conscience and mind. To be sure, early modern philosophy retained the biblical view of God, the Almighty Father, of infinite personality, in contrast to Greek philosophers, who regarded personality and infinity as alternatives, as if personality imposes restrictions on infinity and necessarily qualifies it and limits it. And moreover, modern theists were also more prone to identify God not simply in terms of eternal ideas or forms, but rather in terms both of a divine mind and divine will. And yet, apart from special revelation, modern theists and idealists, Descartes, Leibniz, Hegel, and many others, soon produced highly conflicting views of God. God increasingly appeared to be a phantom difficult to define. To be sure, the moderns shared with the pre-Christian Greek classical philosophers a broad emphasis on the priority of the spiritual world, the eternal world, on the essential uniqueness of man, and on the objective nature of truth and the good. But in contrast to the Greeks on whom they now leaned, more than on Moses, Isaiah, and Paul, the modern philosophers nonetheless unwittingly retained from the Bible certain emphases peculiar to the Judeo-Christian revelation. I've said despite their whittling away at the Judeo-Christian revelation, the early moderns unwittingly retained from that revelation elements that by which they compromised their revolt. They no longer viewed, the modern theists, no longer speculative theists, no longer viewed matter as eternal, as did some of the Greeks. But rather they regarded matter as somehow created, whether by emanation or evolution, but nonetheless not eternal. And they no longer viewed matter and the body as evil, as had the Greeks, but presupposed a divinely gifted body as well as soul. And they expected as the outcome of history a final consummatory kingdom of righteousness, rather than looking to the beginning of history as the only golden age. For all that, because early modern philosophy detached itself from the self-revealing God of the Bible, it could not resist making further concessions to naturalism. Despite its early theistic intentions, modern philosophy slowly but surely came to insist that nature alone is the ultimate reality, that everything is reducible to nature in some form, that man is essentially a complex animal, different in degree but not different in kind from the other animals, that truth and the good are relative and changing. Granted, this was at first the view only of an It's very good, but not all that good. This is the third run today, so you'll have to pardon an occasional infusion. Granted, these naturalistic premises were at first the view only of an elite minority. They had not yet become the covert conceptuality of liberal arts learning, as they did in the last half of the present century. 19th century naturalism, for all its accelerating revolt against the Christian view of things, like speculative theism earlier, nonetheless retained unawares certain elements of the biblical outlook. It identified nature as rational, a logically ordered, law-ordered system. It considered man the apex of nature, although only an animal. Who, in contrast with the other animals, can know the very inner workings of the cosmos. And it considered truth and the good, although changing, to be relatively stable. You could have truth and the good for your generation. So deeply had the biblical view penetrated Western thought that despite their revolt against it, both modern idealism and naturalism clung to certain elements of the Christian tradition. Modernity went into unwitting debt to the biblical heritage. In our century, secular humanism is the form in which naturalism for a half generation has been the masked metaphysics of Western liberal arts learning. Secular humanism affirms that all of reality is reducible to impersonal processes and events. There is no supernatural. There is no ultimate personality. All of reality is reducible ultimately to impersonal processes and events. That all life, including human life, is transient, and its final destiny is the grave. Everything is time-bound. Nothing is enduring. And the truth and the good are distinctions that man himself projects upon nature and history. There are no revealed truths. There are no divine commandments. There is no unchanging good. And man come of age, modern man, repudiates external, objective, transcendent, supernatural good and affirms personal decision and creative selfhood. Man himself imposes upon nature and history the only patterns they will ever bear. And yet, this philosophy, which for 20 years has been the most influential philosophy on our American secular university campuses, and which is not only the controlling philosophy, so far as public education is concerned, is also the philosophy that clearly has undergirded much of the mass media. And not only so, has also shaped much of the political thinking of our day. Yet, alongside these controlled beliefs, secular humanism added an agenda of social concerns. That is, what made naturalism, the view that nature is the ultimate reality to which everything ultimately reduces, what made naturalism, what constituted naturalism, humanism, was that secular humanism added a social agenda or concern for humanity to its particular form of naturalism. And that secular agenda, that social agenda, stressed an emphasis on human dignity, racial equality, on human rights, on ecological concerns. It protested against the exploitation of nature, the rape of nature, the misuse and overuse, the exploitation of natural resources, and so on. This was the social agenda on which secular humanism insisted. Now, evangelical Christians protested this humanist insistence on these social concerns as if a humanist denying the supernatural and the existence of God could save philosophical significance for them. That is, if there is no ultimate personality, no supernatural God, if there is no supernatural and everything is to be explained only in terms of changing natural processes, if man is essentially a time-bound animal, if all philosophical principles and theological tenets and all moral imperatives are ultimately culture conditioned and subject to revision, as naturalism holds, on what ground could humanism insist on the universal validity of these social imperatives, human rights, equality, human equality, ecological concerns, Why should not self-interest rule if everything is reducible to nature and is time-bound? How could one save significance for universally valid ethical principles such as those that the humanists insisted upon? And so evangelicals from the right challenged humanism. Elton Trueblood said, for example, in some of his writings that the humanist social agenda was simply a cut flower agenda that had been broken off its biblical roots, and that it would sooner or later wither, that it could not long retain any significance apart from the theological roots that had nourished those ethical convictions. But the evangelicals were, as they are in Scotland today, pretty well beleaguered and outnumbered, and students were intimidated by the reigning philosophy in the classrooms, and they were concerned to finish their degrees without prejudice. And so the evangelical assault on humanism from the theological right was not very effective. But for the last 10 years, something very remarkable has been taking place. About 8 years ago, I had a call from a black student at Harvard, a graduate student. I had befriended him when he had lost, when he was passed over for a scholarship in an art school in Philadelphia. And in point of fact, I think Dr. Everett Koop, the retired Surgeon General, has been through here too. And I wrote him at that time, and he was one who had also protested the thing. And finally, the decision was reversed and he got his scholarship. And so he's always had sort of a tie to me in his graduate studies. And he called me and he said, "You ought to come up here to Harvard and see what's taking place." And I said, what's happening, what's taking place up there? And he said, "Well," he said, "it's no longer the evangelicals who are assailing secular humanism. It's the radical students on the left. And they are saying, 'Professor, we agree with you that there is no God, that there is no supernatural, that man is only an animal, that everything is culture conditioned, time bound and changing, relative, subject to revision. But on what ground then can you insist on the permanent validity of these social imperatives, on the validity of the humanist social agenda?'" And so he emphasized that these radical students now had an initiative in the classroom over against the humanist professors, and were forcing the humanist professors in the direction of a thoroughgoing raw naturalism. And since the humanist professors, of course, took their stand on human rights and human equality and against racial discrimination, why, these students were very secure in their counterattack against the humanist position in the classroom. So this is what has been happening. And what has led actually to the most recent book that I have written, Twilight of a Great Civilization. In a word, what is happening is that the humanitarianism is now evaporating from the humanism, which for 20 years or so has been the masked metaphysics or the covert metaphysics of modern liberal arts learning. And the result is that we are seeing a sweeping trend to immorality and indecency that I think is unprecedented in the history of the West, at least since the fall of the Roman Empire. And it is a real question whether or not you in Scotland may indeed lag, and I think Wales a little bit lags behind what is happening in England to the south. But sooner or later it will catch up with you. And there's not much difference on the media between what's going down on television particularly, and certainly in our country. Something has happened that represents a quantum leap in terms of the acceleration of immorality, the breakdown of monogamy and the family. We have had in the United States some 10 million abortions in the last 10 years. That's more abortions than Hitler killed Jews at Auschwitz, if you think of that. We have now thousands of abandoned babies in a single year, just left in a trash can or in a hallway or out in an alley. And I've said that no ferocious baboon would treat a cub that way. And vast sexual permissiveness and the sweeping tide of AIDS and all that sort of thing. Well, now, Alasdair MacIntyre wrote a book some years ago, After Virtue, in which he said that whatever the differences may be between the decline of the Roman Empire and what is happening today in the West, there nonetheless came a time within the history of that decline when the Christians had to ask themselves whether it was not imperative to look for new forms of community if virtue was going to survive into the future. Those are significant questions. What does that mean for us, new forms of community? The forms of community in which we are no longer identified with the culture and secular society as much as with some alternative that really defines what our character is and what our commitments are. And Chuck Colson, whom you recognize as a Watergate figure, whom in the providence of God, the gospel dynamic turned around so that he became in the United States and then worldwide the apostle to the prisoners, whom the evangelicals had neglected in the 18th century prison reform and concern for prison conditions, and a ministry to the imprisoned was an evangelical concern. We had let it go by the board, so had the modernists before the evangelicals, for that matter. Nobody cared about the imprisoned. But now we have prison fellowship with a worldwide ministry. Chuck Colson's latest book is titled Against the Night, Against the Dark. And he raises the question whether the great nightfall may not be upon us. And my book, therefore, is titled Twilight of a Great Civilization. Twilight is not yet midnight. And Hegel said that it's when the owl of Minerva flees, that is, wisdom goes, and everything becomes confused. And the real question rises for what it is that you and I count for in a great turning time of history like this one. Now, what we see around us as these Christian commitments by secular philosophy are gradually pared away. And even humanism then is squeezed so that the remnants of a biblical social ethic, humanism had given away personal ethics, wasn't interested very much in personal ethics. You saw it reflected, for example, in our protests of the 60s in the United States, where young people who wanted to protest against certain political positions and so on pitched their tents on the Washington Mall, all the way up from some of the national monuments to the Capitol. Outside, they were raising their banners for social ethic and political protest. But as Time magazine noted, inside the tents, all sorts of immorality was going on. It wasn't a matter of personal ethics, it was social ethics. And so, and I don't want to debunk the protest movement simply in terms of that, but the fact is it was a movement that was oriented to social protest and social ethics and correlated with a great deal of personal permissiveness with regard to the inherited morality. Well, what is happening? What we see around us today, and I'll mention this more briefly, I expound it more fully in the lecture, are several movements that reach for transcendence, for something beyond ourselves, something beyond the forces of history and of nature. Humanism, deprived of its humanitarianism, going down to raw paganism, the last remnants of Christianity being squeezed out of the surviving philosophical traditions of the West. One movement that until recently was quite significant during the last decade, and that is the dialogue between what is called the secular, the radically secular Christian Marxists. What a mouthful. The radically secular Christian, put it in quotation marks, Marxists, and traditional Marxism or communism. Now, you know that tradition of the communism holds that to the inevitable triumph of the proletariat and to economic determinism, and that nothing can frustrate that given, that the forces that exist are in the grip of economic determinism and the triumph of the proletariat is inevitable. Now, the radically secular Christian Marxists attack that premise. They say that for the communist kingdom to arrive, action is necessary. That Christianity insists that our decision is important for the ultimate outcome of things, the future that we will inherit, that mankind will inherit. And so they challenge this determinism, and they call for praxis, for Christian involvement. Of course, they want Christian involvement to promote socialism and communism. That's what they're after. They are Marxists. They're Christian Marxists, radically secular Christian Marxists. What they are doing is trying to rescue nature and history for some semblance of transcendence outside those impersonal processes. Now, with the recent collapse of socialism on every hand, that debate, which was vigorous in Paris and in Berlin and in Yugoslavia especially, and in some other centers, has sort of fallen from significance. But it was one modern reach for transcendence over against that whole communist totalitarian philosophy that said that everything is so loaded that our decision really does not matter. And here is a movement that is trying to save significance for human decision, even if it's not talking about the decision that the gospel requires and a decision for a supernatural God, because these radically secular Christian Marxists and the traditional Marxists all share one premise, that there is no supernatural, and that there is simply a one-layer reality. And so the transcendence they look for is something within this naturalism, but it's a reach for something that renders human decision somehow still significant. Another reach for transcendence would be the drug culture. I don't know how much of it you have in Scotland. This day has been so busy in this week that I haven't been able to ask some of the questions that I wanted to ask since I came. But we have in the United States a vast drug culture. And on its philosophical side, to look at it from that side for just a moment, these young people are protesting against the scientism of the modern world, which says that what is ultimately real is those impersonal processes the science identifies, the formulas that you find in your physics and chemistry textbook. Those are the things you can bank on. That's the ultimately real world. And that means that personality is not real, ultimately. It's something much more ephemeral, secondary. And the drunk culture, in a way, moves around the walls of scientism and reaches above those walls and says, I am real. And it reaches into a transcendent world that leaps over reason, rational distinctions, moral distinctions, and seeks an expansion of consciousness out there in a transcendent world somewhere. Look that scientific, look that philosophically. That's the philosophical aspect of the revolt. This search for personal meaning, this search for personal meaning by taking chemical additives. No personal meaning is offered by scientism, which says that the real world is ultimately reducible to impersonal processes. And so this experience, which soon leads to a restriction rather than an expansion of personal consciousness, which is so self-destructive. Often compared to a religious experience, so-called a psychic orgasm, you know, by the younger generation. To reach into this transcendent world, so forth. Now, we also have in the United States, I mentioned this morning that the evangelicals are the conservative. In the United States, not all churches are growing, but the churches that are growing still are conservative churches. And it is no question about the fact that the charismatic movement is the fastest growing wing of American Protestantism. And what helped that was the fact that Oral Roberts, who belonged to the Pentecostal wing, and Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart, they had television visibility to masses of people. It brought the preacher right into the home one-on-one with people. They knew him in a one-on-one relationship. Here I could have him in my living room and he talks to me for about 30 minutes. You see, the power of television and so on. Of course, that was presumably a more intimate dialogue or relationship to the pastor on television than people had in their churches. The more prominent the ministers, the more difficult the access. I mean, contrast to television, one-on-one. And the Pentecostal churches, though they've not been alone in this, but they are experiential in their orientation rather than theological. There have been no systematic theology that Pentecostalism has shaped. It has spread not only because of television, but also because Pentecostalism is a lay-oriented religion. And it doesn't look to the preacher or the minister to do everything, as a hired representative of the church to do everything. It is a lay-oriented movement in which the Pentecostals share with fellow workers at every level of society their relationship to Christ. And that's part of the secret of the expansion of the Pentecostal movement. But it is, as I say, an experiential, non-dogmatic form of religion. So notice now that just as the drug culture reaches into the transcendent world and leaps the distinctions of truth and falsehood, and good and evil. Those distinctions go by the board. This is a broader form of consciousness that transcends those distinctions. So, too, Pentecostalism reaches into the transcendent world with an emphasis on glossolalia, which is a language that leaps the universal forms of language, and a word of wisdom which leaps the universal forms of reasoning that comes from outside, reaches up into the transcendent world. Now, if I were to stop there, you would greatly misunderstand me. But what I am saying is that here are experience-oriented efforts to break into the transcendent world. Now, to be sure, never did the Pentecostalists think that the way to break into that world was by chemical additives. And surely, although it was not oriented to systematic theology and dogmatics, the Pentecostalists believed in the triune God and in the substitutionary death of Christ and his resurrection for sinners and so on. But American evangelicalism also was largely experientially oriented this past generation. It wasn't only the Pentecostals. They were interested in reading books about Christian experience, much more than about systematic theology, or the sort of thing that Rutherford House is trying to do here, to provide some doctrinal depth and some theological perspective on the times and the movements of thought in our day. So the important thing is that Christianity is not going to count for much if it offers to converted acid heads simply a more intense form of inner experience. What we need to do is to open up that transcendent world as the Bible opens it up for us. God's intelligible revelation, the image of God in man in which human beings are created, and the capacity for rational distinctions and for moral distinctions has always been regarded as an essential aspect of the image of God in man. The significance of Christian doctrine all the way down the road. We need to illumine the times. We need to confront scientism, but not by reaching for some amorphous experience of the transcendent, but by emphasizing the Logos, who is the divine agent in the creation of the world and God's purpose in nature and in history, and to really feel at home once again, as the Protestant reformers did, in the great truths of theology. In the days of the Reformation, the layman knew more Greek than some pastors know today in some of our contemporary church activities. Well, all right, what I'm saying is that we're at the bottom of the barrel, and here are these movements now reaching for some element of transcendence. Even in the communist world, the drug culture, and I could go on. I could say some things about the New Age movement and the revival of Hinduism and Buddhism and the search for divinity within ourselves on the premise that we are all parts of God, who is an all-inclusive self of which we are finite parts and so on. That's an old view that's cropping up into present religious, it's an old view, and that with the occult is cropping up once again, and does periodically. So I won't say anything about that tonight. But I will mention just briefly the new philosophy, and that is deconstructionism, the philosophy of deconstructionism. And it proposes to go, we'll hear a lot about this during the next 10 years. It's already raised up schools of fiction and architecture and so on. It revolts against an objective God, wherever the concept of an objective God is found. not only among contemporary evangelicals or Catholics or Islam or anything like that, also early modern theism, also the God of the Middle Ages, also the God of the classic Greek thinkers, Plato, Aristotle, the Stoics. It goes beyond the behind the whole history of philosophy, skirts the contemporary evangelical movement, contemporary Christianity, contemporary Islam, skirts the Middle Ages, skirts the pre-Christian classic philosophers, goes back to the great pre-classic Greek materialistic philosophers, Democritus and Leucippus, who taught that everything is reducible to atoms in motion, and that man is essentially an aspect of nature. He is made up essentially of impersonal atoms that are collected in a certain way, and that everything that exists expires, is time-bound, and is revisable. That's the one. We are down toward the bottom of the barrel. We are at the bottom of the well, and the well is run dry, and it is very dark. But it would be wrong to say that no one can tell where we are. An unseen presence sporadically breaks the silences and asks the same discomforting question that first sounded in Eden after the fall. Adam, where are you? Someone seems, after all, to know. And through the acrid depths of our crumbling culture, he echoes the same complaint once heard by Jeremiah. My people have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters.